Today, voters in the United Kingdom are going to the polls to cast ballots on, well, casting ballots. And we're joined now by David Rennie, a political editor and Badgett columnist for The Economist, and by Gideon Rachman, a chief foreign affairs columnist for The Financial Times. Welcome, both of you, to our show for today's Backstory segment. Gideon, Hello, let's begin with you. The new election system that's being proposed is called the alternative vote method. How does it work?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that, actually. I don't really completely understand it. It's basically, rather than first past the post where, you know, whoever gets the most votes wins, it's a system where you list your the candidates in order of preference. So you go sort of, my first choice is Republican, my second choice is Democrat, my third choice is Independent, and then this is where it gets tricky. Okay, when one person doesn't get 50% of the vote, the people lower down get eliminated, the preferences get reassigned, and essentially somebody has to get a combination of first and second preferences that gets them over 50% of the vote, and then they're elected.
So this isn't simply a winner-takes-all kind of a system.
It's not a winner-takes-all, and the idea, the people who are in favor of it say that, you know, the old system worked very well when Britain had two big parties, but now that you've got quite a lot of minority parties, you're getting a lot of MPs elected with, you know, maybe 35% of the vote, and that's unsatisfactory.
David, is this used anywhere else in the world that we know of?
The largest democracy that it's used in is Australia, and it's been used there a long time. And it has to be said, it's not a big issue in Australia, but that is partly because Australia has pretty much a two-party system, and two-party systems just have this effect that it doesn't matter nearly so much which voting system you use. It's all pretty clean cut. The problem in the UK is we have a three-party system, which is actually seeing the rise of smaller parties too. And what's really put a strain on elections here is that it used to be the case that almost everyone was either a Conservative or a Labour voter. I was sort of 96% of the people used to vote that way, you know, a half century ago. And now we've seen this real rise of other parties. And so the system is under strain. But I have to say, The Economist agrees with Gideon that AV is just not a simple or clear enough fix for the flaws that do exist in the way we elect MPs.
Well, how is the system being presented by supporters in the UK?
Well, I have to say that it's been an extremely depressing campaign to watch as a citizen and to cover as a journalist. I mean, you have an issue which is a really serious question of what kind of democracy you want. I mean, in very crude terms, the sort of winner-takes-all system we use here and, of course, you use in the States leads to kind of ideological clarity. You know what you're getting. Someone has a clear ideological program. If you don't like them, you can kick the bums out. And that's, I think, the great appeal of the current system. There's no doubt that the system on offer, AV, in this referendum would lead to something much more like the continent of Europe, where you have there's greater rewards for being the kind of consensual politician who can reach out to supporters of other parties and build a majority of support from the kind of soggy middle. It's a different way of doing politics. So you could have had a really interesting discussion about, does Britain want to be the kind of America, kick the bums out, winner takes all kind of democracy, or do we want to be something more European? Instead of which, we've seen these incredibly bad campaigns from the yes and the no camp saying, on the one hand, the no camp saying, it'll cost a lot of money to buy voting machines. That means soldiers in Afghanistan won't have body armor, so we're killing soldiers, which is a pretty crass argument. The yes camp saying, if you make MPs work harder, they won't cheat on their expenses. So if you're offended by MPs claiming for duck houses, vote yes. Neither of these arguments stack up at all. It's been a very depressing campaign.
But the current system is called first past the post. Gideon, there was a transition earlier when Labour started moving into its position as one of the two major parties, but it had been the Liberals and the Conservatives. So what happened during that time? Was the voting system adjusted at all at that time, or is what's in place now pretty much what we've seen for a long time?
It was about a century ago, but as far as I can recall from reading the history books, it was a first past the post system, but it was also associated with one man, one vote. I mean, Britain didn't actually have universal franchise, I think, until 1918,
and women weren't allowed to vote until 1928.
Exactly. And so once we, you know, went down that radical path of allowing the working classes and women to vote, that allowed the rise of Labour rather than any sort of change in the electoral system.
Isn't this the first national referendum since 1975?
It is, yeah. There was one in 1975 on whether we should join whether we should stay in the European Union, or as it then was the European Economic Community. We'd joined that. It was controversial. A referendum was promised, and we voted to stay in the EEC. But oddly, that yes vote was a vote for the status quo, because it was against leaving the European Union. And it looks from the polls as if on this referendum, albeit with a much more kind of low-key and dismal campaign, as David suggested, really hasn't caught anybody's imagination. But it looks, again, as if people are going to vote for the status quo. In this case, no change.
But, David, wasn't this kind of imposed on the Conservative Party by the Liberal Democrats as part of the deal for them to join the governing coalition?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the basic truth is, the whole way this is being sold is that the public is very angry with politicians, is very distrustful of politicians, and thinks that the political system is broken. And there is, unfortunately, quite a lot to that. There is a very sour, distrustful mood. But it just is not the case that voters have been marching up and down saying, you know, what do we want? The alternative vote. You know, this is absolutely not the referendum that ordinary voters would have chosen to hold. And it's kind of farcical, as Gideon says, that this is the first in decades, and we've chosen this incredibly obscure thing. This is a piece of political coalition horse trading. Very soon after David Cameron had to go into coalition with the third party, the Liberal Democrats, simply because he just didn't win a majority in the election a year ago, one of the concessions from the Liberal Democrats was they hate the current voting rules. And to be fair to Liberal Democrats, the current voting system is very, very brutal to Liberal Democrats. They got a quarter of the vote at the last election and one-tenth of the seats in the House of Commons. So they will do anything to change the current system. Do they actually want this system that's on the ballot paper today, this alternative vote we've been discussing? Actually, no, they don't, because it doesn't really help the Liberal Democrats that much. But what they really want to do is kill the current system and then move to their big, big dream, which is a system where a party that gets a quarter of the votes will get a quarter of the seats. And then the Lib Dems would suddenly find themselves as kind of kingmakers in a series of coalition governments. So this has been sort of imposed on everyone, and it's nothing that actually anyone sane has any great enthusiasm for on any side.
Well, that proportional approach is in place in a number of countries, and it often leads to unstable governments, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So,
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt, but since you mentioned it, I was at a briefing with the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu.
I was thinking of Israel.
Today. And mainly he was lecturing us on, you know, the iniquities of Hamas. But right at the end, somebody asked him a sort of British interest question, said, what do you think of our referendum on IEV? And he said, I don't have any opinion on IEV, but I would tell you don't adopt proportional representation. Because, it does make it very, very... You never get any government that's not a coalition. Now, there are those who argue that experience in Germany, for example, Germany's been historically a pretty well-governed country, so having coalitions needn't be such a bad thing. But if you want a very clear change of mandate, a government which is empowered to change things when it comes in, and a change of direction, then proportional representation isn't necessarily the answer.
Hasn't the political environment of the UK shifted? For example, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown are seen as having moved the Labour Party closer to the centre, or even to the right, some might have suggested. They also, there has been autonomy for Scotland, allowing the Mayor of London to be more directly elected. So, is this just part of a larger attempt to enact reforms to make the system a little more workable?
I think it's certainly true that if your listeners were sort of watching the royal wedding last week and they thought, you know, the one thing you can say is that Britain never changes, you know, it is, you know, this kind of time sort of frozen kingdom that doesn't change any of its kind of grand constitutional arrangements. You know, that isn't actually true. You're quite right. We have a Scottish Parliament, we have a Welsh Parliament, we have elected mayors. Things have actually been changing a lot, and we could now see the Liberal Democrats pushing very hard to abolish the House of Lords and have something like an elected Senate is their dream. So there has been a lot of tinkering and changes. I think the sad thing is that there are very good things that you could do, and there are good reasons to shake up some of these things. But the truth is that very little of this has been driven by democratic pressure from down below. This is not what the British electorate is worried about. What, you know, you ask any British voter what's top of their mind right now, and it's fixing the economy, it's paying down the debt, it's are they going to lose their job, is the pound going to stay stable, is their mortgage going to go up? These are the big issues, and it really just looks from the outside, I think, as though Westminster is playing fairly selfish political games. And I think voters are going to get pretty impatient with this stuff.
Aren't the Liberal Democrats themselves an example of how politics changed? The Liberals were one party, and then the Democrats were an offshoot of the Labour Party, weren't they? The more conservative social democratic wing? And then
That's
they merged
right.
together? So there were four parties at one point, weren't there?
That's right. You have the Liberal Party, and it's itself a coalition of, and of course, Liberal means something very different in Britain to the U.S. It doesn't mean someone who's kind of, there is an overlap, but it combines people who are what you would call kind of free market capitalist supporters, supporters of free trade, and supporters of a slightly smaller state in the British context, with people who are frankly just kind of, as you say, an offshoot of the Labour Party. I think where everything is massively in flux is we have this coalition government, which was born out of the fact that British voters did not want Labour to stay in office, but were not convinced that the Tories deserved a majority government. But without choosing a coalition consciously, that's kind of what the British public imposed on the politicians. And now we're still working through the oddity of this, because the Liberal Democrats had thrived in recent years by kind of positioning themselves as a left-wing conscience to the left of Labour, very strongly opposing the Iraq War, for example. That was a signature issue for them. And so an awful lot of people at the last election were kind of voting Liberal Democrat on the basis that they were somehow a left-wing conscience, and then they ended up in coalition with the Conservatives. So the fallout from that is going to take a long time to work through the system, and the whole thing is very much in flux.
And Nick Clegg, since he's the head of the Liberal Democrats, since he's put so much of his energy behind this, you suggest that this is going to go down to defeat. Does that mean that he will be replaced?
Well, there are names floating around of people under him who might try to replace him. I mean, the thing is, there is no doubt that Nick Clegg is having a pretty miserable time. I mean, he is being burned in effigy in the streets by students who are angry about broken promises to do with university funding. I mean, that's not much fun. If you come from the Liberal Democrats, who basically for years were the kindly non-political party that was everybody's friend, and then you're suddenly being burned in effigy in the streets, that's a pretty unpleasant journey he's taken over the last year. That said, the crude calculation at the moment will be, if the Liberal Democrats were to walk out of the government and do anything that actually triggered an early election, that looks a lot like political suicide, because they are currently flatlining in the opinion polls, and as you say, Nick Clegg being burned in effigy. So he has a pretty strong reason, no matter how wretched and miserable life is right now, to stay in the coalition.
Gideon, just one more thing. The House of Commons is also set to shrink, isn't it, from 650 to 600? And there's been talk again about abolishing or reforming the House of Lords. So are we going to see more change in the near future?
Yeah, I mean, I think that actually the kind of great secret of the appearance of British continuity, which David referred to, and, you know, epitomized, I guess, by the royal wedding, is that beneath the surface there's always been a process of adaptation and change. We've always gone for evolution rather than revolution. And I think that there is now finally a move to shrink the House of Commons, because MPs are basically rather unpopular. I think the expenses scandal has made people think that there are too many of these people just sort of living off the state, as they're regarded as doing. And so they're going to, as part of the reapportionment of constituencies, slightly shrink the House of Commons, even though actually the population is rising. And then this perennial question of House of Lords reform, which has been going on, you know, really ever since Labour came in 1997, and they've been sort of messing around with various ideas. They've got rid of hereditary peers now, but nobody has yet quite had the guts to move towards an elected second chamber, because it would have a perverse effect. Once you have an elected second chamber, that would become more legitimate, and therefore it would become more of a challenger to the House of Commons, and the House of Commons rather likes being the only really powerful chamber. So people haven't quite made their minds up what to do with the House of Lords, but it's certainly in play.
Gideon Rackman is a chief foreign affairs columnist for the Financial Times, and David Rennie is a political editor and Badgett columnist for The Economist. Thank you for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.